What led the Detroit Public School District to walk away from perfectly good buildings? Turns out, it's all about the numbers.
So the school district was faced with a choice. You have a successful school academically, but it's designed for 2,200 students. It only has 380 in there. What do you do?
I'm Lester Graham. Today on Stateside, we look at the decline of the Detroit Public School District. But first, last night, the four Republicans running for their party's nomination for president met at the Fox Theater in Detroit for the, by my count, 11th debate. Donald Trump was much of the focus. He told the audience he has a quality the other candidates don't.
I've never seen a successful person who wasn't flexible, who didn't have a certain degree of flexibility. You have to show a degree of flexibility. If you're going to be one way and you think it's wrong, does that mean the rest of your life you have to go in the wrong direction because you don't want to change?
Joining us to talk about the debate is Member of Congress John Molinar, a Republican from Michigan's 4th District. So how did having the smallest number of candidates during one of these GOP debates add to the picture of who these men are?
Well, I think it gave the viewers an opportunity to get to know each of the candidates on a more individual basis, talk more policy, foreign policy, domestic policy. And I thought it was a good debate. Obviously, Donald Trump is a big personality, and so he dominates a lot of the coverage. But I thought Marco Rubio did outstanding in terms of his leadership on foreign policy and his ability to speak to the issues facing the American people.
What do you think of that comment that Trump is flexible while the other candidates are entrenched in their own ideology?
Flexibility is important because when you're working with Congress, you want to be able to get things done. And I think you want people who have shown an ability to do that. Marco Rubio has been able to do that over the years, both in the state legislature as well as in Congress. The key question, though, is you have to have some guiding principles and you have to have some firm convictions in order to lead. And I think those are the questions that were being raised about Donald Trump last night because he's been on so many different sides of so many different issues.
The tone and tenor of the past few debates have been described as schoolyard fights. How fair is that description?
Well, I think all of us would agree we'd like to see a presidential debate where the issues are the focus and not the personalities and some of the back and forth. You know, quite frankly, Donald Trump has been the instigator of a lot of these kinds of attacks against all the candidates whenever someone is threatening him.
Congressman, of course, you've endorsed Marco Rubio. What do you think of his change in tactics in the last couple of debates in attacking Donald Trump, insinuating Trump wet his pants, or picking up on the allegations that Mr. Trump has small hands?
Well, I think a lot of that banter was going back and forth. I think the real question is, you know, what kind of a leader would Donald Trump be? And I think this question about Trump University, did he mislead people? Is he being authentic with the voters? Those are the real questions that are being raised about Donald Trump. I think Marco Rubio has a record of leadership on foreign policy. When you hear him speak about the issues facing our country, our security, he has a deep understanding. And I think one of the questions is Donald Trump capable of understanding issues at that level? And what kind of a leader would he be?
Congressman John Molinar is a Republican from Midland. Thanks for the time.
Thank you very much.
This is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. Last week on this program, we spent a fair amount of time talking about an underground plume of a contaminant that over the decades has been spreading. There is concern it might eventually threaten Ann Arbor's water supply. This chemical, 1,4-dioxane, has already contaminated some private wells in Scio Township west of Ann Arbor. This week, Ryan Stanton, a reporter with MLive and Ann Arbor News, wrote a story about another contaminated well, and he joins us now. Ryan, you've been following this story for a while. Tell us where this chemical came from and how it's been spreading underground.
This is not a new issue. It's been around for 50 years. This thing goes back to the mid-60s. Gelman Sciences, located on Wagner Road there, just by Liberty, border Scio Township, Ann Arbor, they dumped this chemical dioxane into the environment back in the 60s through the mid-80s, and it has created a plume that has continued to spread through Ann Arbor and Scio Township.
This contaminated well is being used by a family who didn't realize what a significant toxin this was in their water. Who are they, and what do we know about the situation?
Wesley and Heather Pate, they live out on Jackson Road, just west of Wagner Road in Scioto Township, just west of Ann Arbor. They've lived there about 2.5 years. They've got 3 young children. They claim they had no idea that their water was unsafe. You know, they kind of had an idea something was going on, and they knew about testing, but they got these reports that said, your reading is at this level, and this is the safe standard, and they were led to believe it was safe. We're finding out if you look at federal guidelines, maybe that's not quite true, and they're alarmed now.
So what kind of levels were detected in their drinking water?
The Paul Corporation, which bought Gelman Sciences back in 1997, they've been doing the testing on this well at this house for over a decade. I mean, it was in the 50s, a little over a decade ago, 50 parts per billion. That went down to in the 30s by around 2010. It's hanging around 17 parts per billion right now.
So the state level is 85 parts per billion. So that's under the state level. But there's been a lot of criticism of how high that is. It changed in 1995. Prior to that, it was a lot lower. Now they're talking about reassessing what's hazardous, what's safe. Where is that?
The U.S. Environmental Protection Agency came out with a report in 2010 that suggested going to a single-digit standard. You have local officials that have been lobbying pretty hard to, you know, they're saying the EPA standard should be 3.5 parts per billion to result in 1 in 100,000 cancer risk, which
that's,
is...
That's 3.5 parts per billion rather than the 85 parts per billion.
Yeah, you know, we've been talking about, you know, for half a decade now, moving the state in line with some of this federal science from the EPA, which the state law actually required. The state law, if you look at the Part 201 standard, says by December 2013, the department needs to promulgate rules that are in line with federal science and the latest science. And that deadline was missed, so the state is not in compliance with state law, and there have just been delays after delays, and we still don't have a revised standard. We're still at 85, and that has left people like the Pate family on Jackson Road with no recourse for what's in their well right now.
Has the Pate family experienced any ill effects because of this exposure to the chemical in the water? Do we know that?
What they say is they've had a lot of problems with their children. They've gone to doctors that couldn't explain why their kids were running high fevers, were breaking out in hives, you know, all kinds of scary stuff, asthma problems, coughing. They have a one-year-old daughter, a two-year-old son, and a three-year-old son, and one of their sons has had some growth challenges. They're saying he isn't gaining weight, and the mother, she's had kidney and liver problems, which can be caused by dioxane if you read the technical review sheet from the EPA, and there is a risk of cancer from dioxane, and they don't know what the long-term consequences are for this family yet. We've got public health nurses that were out there yesterday, or a public health nurse from Washtenaw County Public Health was checking out their story, and they're taking this seriously and looking into it.
This is not the only family pulling water from this private well. Who else has been drinking the water?
So you've got this property off Jackson Road there. This well is actually on the residential property, but it also feeds into the two nearby businesses, a furniture restoration shop and a recording studio. And one of them knew about the situation, one of them didn't. So,
and presumably they're not preparing meals with this or bathing in it.
Yeah, I haven't talked to them too much. I did talk to the furniture restoration owner, company owner yesterday, and she said, yeah, anybody who's lived in Ann Arbor for 5 minutes knows there's dioxane in the water out here. And so I've been bringing bottled water to work for years, and that's where she's at, and I don't know too much about the other business tenant right now.
Speaking of bottled water, you quoted Bob Wagner with the Michigan Department of Environmental Quality as saying the state would supply bottled water to anyone on well water with dioxane levels above the anticipated levels, somewhere around or below 10 parts per billion. Is the Pate family getting that water?
Yeah, so finally, as of yesterday, As of yesterday, the DEQ showed up at their door at 11 a.m., right when the county was there. The county actually fired off a pretty feisty email to the DEQ on Wednesday and said, we're going to show up at their doorstep tomorrow with water since you guys aren't doing it. So it was kind of this race, and the DEQ and the county both showed up with water at the same time, and the county set up a big 5-gallon jug with a, you know, turned upside down on a dispenser so they can kind of squirt out cups of water, and the DEQ brought 24 packs of Aquafina or I think that was the brand. So they've got a stockpile of water now, and that's going to continue until they can get Paul Corporation, the company responsible for the pollution, to actually extend municipal water service out that way.
I can't imagine how anxious the Pate family must be. What's been their reaction to this new information, for them new information, that their water might be contaminated to the point it could affect their health?
I asked the father, I said, are you freaked out? And he said, I'm past freaked out. He's already got an application in to move to a new house. They're trying to move immediately. That might actually have them move to the city of Jackson, which is the closest he could find in a hurry, I guess. They're trying to get out of there as fast as they can, and I know they're just really alarmed right now.
So I have to go back just a little bit. Why did the DEQ wait so long to bring them bottled water? Is it because they were not in exceeding the 85 parts per billion?
Yeah, so though we've had for years now some federal scientific data suggesting our standard was outdated and that 85 was way too high a number, the state, you know, from a regulatory standpoint, has continued to operate under that being the acceptable standard. So the state has watched these reports come in, you know.
So they knew this family was drinking this water and it exceeded federal levels but didn't exceed what is the outdated
state level. The DEQ's response yesterday was, you know, when I asked why didn't this happen sooner, the delivery of water sooner, they said, you know, we're operating under 85 as the standard, and that's just what it was, and we assumed they were getting the reports from Paul Corporation that showed them what their number was and that they could make sense of that. And obviously this family did not make sense of it. They said, we're not scientists. And if you actually read the reports, they were coming from Paul Corporation. So Paul's the one that's been informing the family of the dioxin in their water. The polluter is the one telling them, you know, explaining everything to them. And what they say is, your water is perfectly safe to drink.
Ryan Stanton is a reporter for MLive Ann Arbor News. He wrote the story this week, headlined, Family with Three Children Living in Home with Dioxane Poisoned Water. Thanks for coming in, Ryan.
Thank you.
Coming up, the state of Michigan gets more than 2 million cyber attacks per day.
It's because state government has a lot of critical information that we want to try to protect. And, you know, if you think about the financial institutions, right, financial institutions get hit a lot more than we do.
In 10 minutes, how the state can protect critical information from cyber attacks. This is Stateside from Michigan Radio. This is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. Last week, I was being led through an abandoned building in Detroit.
First time we came in here in 2013, it was still relatively intact. The power was off, but pretty much everything else was in decent shape. It wasn't in great shape, but just a matter of months, and this place was completely destroyed.
So who would walk away from a perfectly good building, fail to secure it to keep metal thieves out? Well, it's the Detroit Public School District.
We're inside Hutchins Intermediate School.
Stepping over the broken concrete and leaf litter from people dumping in here.
Let's try and get to the debris. So Hutchins was built in 1922. It was actually one of a few prototype schools. It was very innovative for its time. In the early 1920s, the education system as we know it was really starting to come together, in particular public education.
John Grover works with Loveland Technologies. He and Yvette Vandervelde co-authored the report, A School District in Crisis. We're walking through the Hutchins building because the authors think it's a classic example of how nearly 200 buildings have been closed in the last 20 years, how neighborhoods have suffered, and how the Detroit School District continues to spiral downward.
Hutchins was one of the first purpose-built intermediate schools. Before, a lot of junior high schools and high schools were just old converted elementary schools, but Hutchins and its twin on the other side of the city, Barber, were designed for junior high school students. So it had a number of innovations. It had gymnasiums, swimming pools. It was also one of the first schools designed specifically for community use. They envisioned it not only as a place of education, but also for the neighbors to come in and use, like, the auditorium for meetings or to use the gymnasiums or the swimming pools after hours. So Hutchins really was the center of this neighborhood.
And when was it shut down?
2012.
That recently?
Yes.
Wow.
The damage that you see here was done in maybe 6 months. Some of it's longer term. The weather does a lot of it. The tiles coming off of the ceiling, that's just a result of water getting in. But, you know, these used to be lockers here, this giant gap in the wall. They would just come in and the scrappers would just come in and rip out the entire bank of lockers and walk straight out the door with them.
Looking at the remnants of this grand three-story brick and stone building,
the oak-paneled library, the gyms, the swimming pools, the auditorium. You wonder why the school district walked away from it. As the old saying goes, they don't build them like this anymore. Grover says it's all about the numbers.
Around 2006, there were only about 380 students going to school here. So the school district was faced with a choice. You have a successful school academically, but it's designed for 2,200 students. It only has 380 in there. What do you do? So what they ended up doing is they closed the program that was inside of this school, the Hutchins Intermediate Program. They moved it to another school about 10 blocks to the south called McMichael Intermediate, and that became Hutchins at McMichael. And the feeling was you could just pick up all the students, all the teachers, the program that was so successful here, and transplant it into another school.
But many students refused to be transplanted. They left the district. It was either that or walk 10 blocks through rival gang territory to go to the new school. They went to charter schools, they went to inner-ring suburban schools. Now, this is not new. Since 2000, the Detroit Public School District went from 162,000 students to 47,000 students. That's a loss of 115,000 in 15 years. Back at the Loveland Technologies office in downtown Detroit, John Grover explained what they found as they studied the history of Detroit schools.
Studies found that about 30% of the students from a closing school would leave the district altogether and go to different schools. With each student having a price tag on their head of between $6,000 and $7,000 a year in student funding, the loss of those students is a tremendous financial hit. You're talking about losing hundreds of thousands of dollars just by moving the school from one location to another. Then there were the follow-up costs. When they were doing some of the closings in 2004, 2005, they found that the anticipated cost saving from closing those schools was actually more or less wiped out in the first year by the one-time costs of moving everything out, the logistics of moving the students to a new building, preparing the building to receive them, then securing the old building and maintaining the old building. And as the years went on, the amount of money that they sunk into securing the buildings, especially after the scrappers started to come in, they would break in, damage the water pipes, the electrical wiring, start ripping that out. The cost of keeping up with the scrappers, keeping the building secure, dispatching the police every time that they had a burglar alarm going off was extremely high as well. And then after the building became essentially a rotted out husk, now they have to come up with the money to demolish them, which can range anywhere from $130,000 for a small school building to upwards of $500,000 to $1 million for a larger building. Those costs, all those costs after the closure, were not factored into the anticipated savings. And the loss of students, the permanent loss of 30% of students when you close a school, as well as all of those after the closing costs, has essentially made closing the school building not practical anymore. They know that the benefits of closing the school are outweighed by the costs of closing it.
Grover says for the entire history, the Detroit Public School District has struggled to get it right. That's why the Loveland team felt they had to start at the year the district was founded, 1842.
Some of the problems that the Detroit Public Schools are facing today have their roots dating back to the 1850s, the 1860s. Issues that they had then, including segregation, are still being felt today. So rather than taking a look at just a slice of the school district's history, we took a look at the entire history to see how we got to where we are today.
The study found there was only one short period of time Detroit was able to hit the sweet spot, but white flight and automotive decline were already beginning.
It's a tale of extremes. The school district, when it was founded, really struggled to provide enough seats and teachers for the number of students that wanted to attend. There were chronic shortages in buildings. The district was underfunded. And that struggle went on through the automotive boom, the First and Second World Wars. But towards the end of the 1950s and 1960s, the school district peaked. And just when they had enough capacity, enough schools, enough teachers, that's when the decline began. And now the school district is struggling with having too many buildings, too many teachers for the number of students that it has.
At the district's peak, there were about 300,000 kids going to Detroit public schools in 370 buildings. Today, 47,000 kids in 91 buildings. Compare those two numbers. That's 810 kids per building at the peak, 516 kids per building this year. The Loveland Report concludes Detroit Public Schools faces a no-win scenario. With no additional money, already substandard schools will get worse. The 1,700 teachers will get no substantive pay raises in the future. That will lead to a further exodus of experienced teachers and larger classroom sizes. The cost of trying to monitor and maintain or demolish closed buildings is a continuing drain on finances. The debt, which has continued to grow under state emergency management, is crippling. So the report leaves the residents and the government with this question: are Detroit's public schools worth saving? And if so, how? This is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. Shortly after national news outlets picked up the Flint water contamination story, the hackers group Anonymous claimed it was launching a cyber attack against the state of Michigan's official website. The group said it would, quote, remind the city officials of Flint that we do not forget and we do not forgive. So the message was to the city, but the claim was to hack the state, which is confusing to me, but that's typical of Anonymous, I think. The International Business Times reported the state's website did go down a couple of times. This is a more public example of the kinds of cyber attacks that happen to government, business, and schools all the time. Joining me now is David Behan. He's the director of the Michigan Department of Technology Management and Budget. He's also Michigan Chief Information Officer. So let's start with that threat from Anonymous. Did the group temporarily knock out the state's official website?
Yeah, they did. It probably happened a couple times.
I'm wondering, how often does the state get hit by cyber attacks?
We stop about 2.1 million attacks a day.
A day?
A day. And that is, you know, through various forms of cyber attacks.
I was going to say, what kind of attacks? Are we just talking about phishing expeditions, the PH phishing?
Yeah, we have phishing, we have malware, we have bots attacking us, you know. And it's because state government has a lot of critical information that we want to try to protect. And, you know, if you think about the financial institutions, right, financial institutions get hit a lot more than we do. They're protecting, obviously, personally identifiable information and financial information. We're protecting really all of the above as well. You know, Social Security numbers, driver's data, healthcare data, really personally identifiable information for citizens of the state of Michigan.
Yeah, sure. Treasury's got all our tax information. Yeah. If you've ever been on Medicaid, they've got health information. I can imagine there's a lot of sensitive information. I understand the state spends somewhere around $25 to $30 million a year on cybersecurity. That right? Does it cost that much?
Yeah, I mean, cybersecurity, if you think about it, really didn't exist up until about 10, maybe 12 years ago. And so over the past few years, especially since 2011, we've been investing heavily in cybersecurity. And it's really to protect our data, build the systems to protect our data, but also really to focus on prevention, detection, and response. If you look around the world today, you know, there's a lot of organizations who have cyber attacks, cyber breaches, cyber incidents, and we need to be prepared as a state to react to those.
Now, you talked about personal identification material, you know, in our tax records and our medical records and the many different business transactions we have with the state. Are there other state issues that are of concern that you don't want those outside from seeing? I mean, I imagine there are police systems or other issues that the state is in charge of that are sensitive information as well.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, there's always obviously the public safety information, but there's also, I go back to the personally identifiable information on the 9.4 million citizens of the state of Michigan. That's the information that we really want to protect from getting out there. You know, you brought up the tax records, right? That's a good example. I mean, that's really personal information that people are entrusting us, state government, to secure. And so we do our best job every day to try to do that.
So let's go beyond the state of Michigan itself. The energy grid is often mentioned as a vulnerable target. Are Michigan's utilities working with state officials on securing the grid from an online threat?
Yeah, actually, there's a lot of collaboration. That's one of the things I'm most proud of in my role to state government, is that we really do partner with other governments, education, and our private sector. We have something called our kitchen cabinet, the CIO kitchen cabinet. We also have the chief security officer kitchen cabinet. And it's really a group of people from private sector companies, education, and government that get together once a month with the CIOs. The CSOs get together every other month. And we talk about cybersecurity issues. We talk about talent issues, because those are the two things that impact us the most, no matter what size organization you are. Getting back to the question about the energy folks do a really good job when it comes to cybersecurity. Our critical infrastructure folks, they're leading the way because of what they do is so important. And so when you talk about our critical infrastructure folks, they're doing a good job. They do work with the state, but they also work with other critical infrastructure organizations and the private sector heavily to ensure that they're secure.
So people are concerned about their votes being hijacked, this being an election year. Can someone hack into a system and steal an election? That's a concern that's been mentioned, or elections for that matter. What can you tell me about that as a threat?
I'm smart enough never to say nothing can get hacked, right? If you look around the world today, organizations are getting breached and hacked every day. We haven't seen that happen yet. We work very closely with the Secretary of State's office and their great team there. And we do everything we can to ensure that those elections are safe, secure, and done appropriately.
I was reading about Michigan's cyber range. Your department, the Michigan Economic Development Corporation, and the National Guard are all involved with that, training cybersecurity experts. I understand that's now open to businesses. How does that work?
So the Michigan Cyber Range, yeah, it's a great collaboration between government, education, and business for sure, critical infrastructure folks. If you think about the old firing ranges and the old, you know, bombing ranges where you kind of blew up a target and you went in and you did research and development on it. Think about that in the cyber world. We have Merit Networks, who does the Michigan Cyber Range with us, has an air gapped, which is kind of a, I can describe it as a internet, but on its own.
Right.
And they can put in malware and viruses, and they can test products, and they can do red team, blue team exercises, which is good guy versus bad guy, and really train individuals and teams.
So if you were going to, let's say at the state level, implement a new software to deal with one issue or another, you'd be able to test it through this first. They'd be able to try to hack into it, send you all kinds of nasty software to try to break into it and make it dysfunctional. Is that what we're talking about?
Yeah, the team at Michigan Cyber Range can do that. I'd be remiss to not say they also offer great classes. You know, all these security classes for entry-level folks, mid-level cybersecurity professionals, so they can get some certifications really build that talent.
That's what I want to get to. And I understand small businesses and corporations can now work with that. They can enroll in these programs as well.
Yeah, right? Absolutely. And it's a great resource for small to medium businesses as well. They're an affordable, very good organization where people can go in and get real good hands-on cybersecurity training.
So what's the ultimate goal for Cyber Range? I mean, do you want to get everybody who's online up to speed on this, or at least their IT folks?
People are growing up with technology in their hands. I think that's the education and awareness piece that's most important. I think the Michigan Cyber Range can do that for small, medium, even some large companies as well. And I think they're well-suited. They're an unclassified range and Cyber Range. And I think they
What does that mean, unclassified?
So you have the classified ones that are mostly Department of Defense.
Oh, right.
Those, but this is unclassified,
you
so everybody can
classified.
Use it.
Okay. Yeah. 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 From the outside looking in, it appears the struggle over cybersecurity is a game of escalation. I mean, with identity theft, corporate espionage, malicious hackers, how are we expected to keep our information safe? What can we as individuals do?
So I always like to talk about education and awareness. In my professional life at the state of Michigan, we have approximately 50,000 employees. And every other month, they're required to take 10-minute online training. We call it sticky. Sticky is that it's very interactive. And so we ask them to do that. And it teaches them things like changing your password, public Wi-Fi. What do you have to do to secure your device when you're going on a public Wi-Fi? Where do you lose your smart devices? How do you secure your smart devices with codes and pins and stuff like that? But I think probably the most important thing, if I was talking to somebody, when I talk to family members or friends, most important thing I tell them to do is change their password. Make sure it's a complex password, certain number of
people
characters.
Must love you. Nobody right. likes to change their password. It's a hassle.
But really, change your passwords. And then I also tell them to change their security words, their security questions as well at the same time. You know, and it can't be, what street did you grow up on? Pretty much anybody, Google, you can find that out. So So it's got to be something that's unique to you that only you understand. They say that about 85 to 90% of cyber incidents or cyber breaches could be thwarted by just basic cyber hygiene, they call it. So really making sure people know the basics around cybersecurity. That's what I really push.
Clean up that personal ID information. Okay, that's David Behan. He's the director of Michigan Department of Technology Management and Budget and Michigan's chief information officer. Thanks for coming in. Thanks for the tips.
Oh, this was great. Thanks a lot. Anytime.
The state of Michigan has a website which offers some tips and tools. That's at michigan.gov/cybersecurity. Still to come, President Obama's plan to address climate change is now on hold because of the Supreme Court. The question is, what does this mean for Michigan? We'll hear more about that in 10 minutes. This is Stateside from Michigan Radio. This is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. Michigan is rich in breweries. Locally brewed beers and ales are being served up in every corner of the state. And a new brewery is looking for public investment. But this concept has a twist. It's a cooperative, a co-op. Joining me to talk about High Five Co-op Brewery is Jim Jones. He's a board member and director at High Five. So I'm all for another fine Michigan brew house, but why a co-op? In fact, let's start by defining co-op.
Well, a co-op is a business organization that is owned by the people who use the services. And that can be true for anything ranging from credit unions to a rural electric co-op to a food co-op or housing co-op or, in this case, a brew pub co-op.
So the cost of membership, as I understand it, will end up being the investment in the co-op? Explain that to me.
Well, there's two different levels of that. We have a regular membership. We call them member owners, actually, because when you buy a share in the cooperative, you become a part owner of the organization. So the membership share costs $150. And what we're doing now is collecting additional money from our members that would be investment shares, we call them. And that can be any amount, minimum of $1,000.
What are you using that money for?
That money would be used for the startup expenses. Just like any investment, if we were a regular private business, we would be collecting investments for everything from the initial construction on a location to the equipment that we would need to the bar where we would be serving.
Now, there was quite a bit of news coverage of the Tecumseh Brewing Company in Tecumseh, Michigan. It was the state's first crowdfunded brewery. How does investment in a co-op differ from a crowdfunding model?
Right, that's a good question. In a crowdfunding model, you've got investment is not really the right word. It's more like a donation. You don't have any kind of control or ownership of the organization that you're giving the money to. In a co-op, when you have an investment of even that minimum of $150 as a member owner, you have the ability to direct the co-op or become involved with the co-op in some way. Usually that would mean a vote for the members on the board of directors.
Now, your members have already been active. High Five Co-op's been brewing beer without a facility. How does that work? How does that happen?
Well, we're not actually brewing as a organization. We don't have our own equipment yet. But what we've been doing is working with some of the other local breweries here in Grand Rapids to do some collaboration brews. White Flame, Final Gravity, Hopcat, we've been doing collaboration brewing with them. In other words, using their equipment and working with them to come up with a beer that can be served in their establishment.
Oh, nice. Well, you talked about how there are different kinds of co-ops. I mean, some of these can become really big corporations. For instance, a dairy that supplies Michigan and several other states, Prairie Farms Dairy, is a big co-op. There are orange juice co-ops, cheese co-ops, housing co-ops. So what will High Five look like in the future? How big can this get?
Well, the prototype really is Black Star Cooperative in Austin, Texas. They were the first one ever, as far as we can find out. They had their first meeting in 2006 and opened in 2010. So they aren't very old yet, and it's a little bit hard to tell what they're going to end up looking like, but they're already working on a second location down in Austin and have 3,500 members. So it's quite possible that something similar to that could happen here, too.
3,500 members. I mean, co-op members will have a hand in making the brewery work, I understand. There's an old saying, too many cooks ruins the stew. How do you handle a situation where everybody's got a great recipe or a method or a kind of brew they want?
Well, absolutely. We're going to have a brewmaster, of course, and our members will have an opportunity to work with the brewmaster in creating some of our beers. But we do have to have that kind of quality control from the brewmaster in order to make it a quality product and ensure that kind of quality. We also will have, of course, a lot of the members will not be involved in the brewing. The 3,500 down in Austin are not all involved with brewing.
Right.
But they have a lot of say in what happens with the place and what is produced and the quality. And if they don't like what they're getting, they have a chance to change the board and change that too.
Jim Jones is a board member and director at High Five Cooperative Brewery in Grand Rapids. Jim, thanks very much and good luck.
Okay, thank you very much, Lester.
Last month, the United States Supreme Court blocked President Obama's climate change rules. The EPA rule would have required states to reduce carbon emissions from its power plants. It was based on the output of each state's power usage. It was a surprise move because lower courts had not yet come to a judgment on the rules. The question is, what's this all mean for Michigan? Joining us is James Clift. He's the policy director for the Michigan Environmental Council. Michigan utilities have been working to adhere to renewable standards, shutting down older, more polluting coal-burning power plants, and investing modestly in solar power and shifting to more natural gas, which emits half of the carbon emissions of coal. So what happens now?
You know, I think everyone has decided, hey, we need to keep moving forward. You know, we have more older coal plants that are going to need to be shut down, so we have to start planning for our future. You look at the Supreme Court, it's told the EPA it can regulate carbon. They're just not sure about the way they went about it this time. So I don't think anybody thinks that we're not eventually going to get around to regulating carbon. We look at this and say, hey, Michigan's been doing a pretty good job. We've been doing this steady transition over to clean energy. If we just keep it up, the federal rule should not be a problem for us at all. I think our biggest fear is that we stall, we don't continue the transition, we wait a couple of years, and then we're behind the eight ball.
I want to talk about this stay by the Supreme Court because, as you mentioned, it had already ruled the EPA could regulate carbon emissions. What is the issue with the rule as it's written that the Supreme Court jumped in like this?
Yeah, again, this is an interesting pollutant because, of course, carbon is not something that you can just put a piece of pollution control equipment on a plant and capture. I mean, there is carbon sequestration, but I think this one most people see as the most viable alternatives is actually switching to other fuels or doing more energy efficiency. It's a little different in that regard, so I think that's why they're coming under a little more scrutiny.
The Michigan legislature has been working on energy legislation this year. I understand renewable energy advances would be limited to things such as allowing burning used tires to be considered a renewable energy. Will this move by the U.S. Supreme Court affect Michigan's energy future as far as legislation is concerned this year?
I think it could. I think it puts a little bit more emphasis on the legislature to write the rules of what's going to come next for Michigan. You know, as I said, our biggest fear is that we stall and we don't do anything. There's actually been some fairly productive conversations about continuing our transition on renewable energy. There's been talk of actually cleaning up that definition you mentioned. But a lot of people, a lot of economic development has occurred in the state since 2008 when we passed our original energy law. And what we'd hate to see is those companies that have joined in those efforts to see them have to lay off workers because we're not doing anything.
Right. I read that renewable energy has created a lot of jobs, particularly in wind and solar energy. First, are those jobs dependent on government subsidies? And second, how will this decision by the Supreme Court affect growth in that job market?
Yeah, again, I think everyone saw that renewables and energy efficiency were going to be key to complying with any carbon rule moving forward. So I think that's going to be important to kind of keep those sectors engaged. You know, the bottom line on subsidies is that every form of energy is subsidized.
Right.
You know, coal, natural gas, renewables, they all collect subsidies of some sort. Congress did just extend some of the subsidies in the renewable area, so it really is a buyer's market for renewable energy right now. And that's the other problem with waiting, is those subsidies will slowly phase out over time under the new plan. So if you're going to build renewables, now's the time to do it. That's why we're a little more concerned about the stalling at this point.
Well, some politicians are skeptical, still skeptical, about climate change in general. The scientific community, of course, is nearly unanimous in thinking that it's man-made, action is needed. How will this affect the energy industries? You know, politicians and politics and court rulings aside, if we're actually seeing change, I've seen, you know, Lloyd's of London decide that they're going to start reinsuring companies and places because of climate change. Much of the industry, much of corporate America and the world is taking this seriously at this point. The politicians are kind of lagging behind.
Yeah, I think that's true. I think more and more people are realizing this is real. The more we can do to mitigate it is going to reduce our potential future cost. So let's get serious about this. You look at polls these days, and voters are saying, hey, they want to elect people who want to deal with this issue, who want to tackle this one and start addressing it. I think those are good news, you know, for politicians anyway, give them a little bit more cover to move forward. I mean, the good news for Michigan is that, hey, the price of renewables is cheap. Energy efficiency is the most cost-effective way to meet future demand. So by moving in these directions, it's really a no-regret policy. We're getting cheaper, stable rates. We're getting reduced health impacts from those dirtier old coal plants. And we're creating jobs in Michigan. So it really is kind of a smooth path forward and not something that people should fear.
James Clift is the policy director for the Michigan Environmental Council. Thanks for talking with us.
Thank you, Lester.
This is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. It's been another week of news about how Flint's water has been contaminated and the state's actions, or inactions. Crucial new information and headlines keep coming every day, sometimes multiple times a day. But on Fridays, at least for a little while, we want to go behind the headlines and get behind the scenes with our reporters in Flint. Many of them have been covering this story for months, and sometimes big, tragic stories like this have a way of hitting close to home. Sometimes too close, and that's the case with my colleague Lindsay Smith. No doubt, like many parents across Michigan, she started to wonder about her own child's lead levels, and her baby was tested. So, Lindsay, how'd that happen?
I have an 18-month-old. She got her blood tested back in August, right around her birthday, which is not uncommon. Usually when they test kids' blood for lead levels, they do it around 1 year old, because the most common way that kids are exposed to lead still is through lead paint, chips and paint dust. It's right around 1 year old where they start putting that stuff in their mouths. Her test came back at what they call 5 micrograms per deciliter of blood. And 5 micrograms per deciliter of blood is the cutoff. It's actually just the borderline where if your child tests at that level or above, that's when you'd get notified. If it comes in below that level, you might not even find out about it. Those kids that test 5 or above are in the highest 2.5% of children tested for lead in their blood in the country. So statistically, it's significant at that point.
So do you know where she was exposed to this lead?
No, we don't. We're still trying to figure that out. I right away decided to get my water tested, and the results of that test are actually really good. And then I also was able to contact the city of Grand Rapids and ask them, you know, as Joe Blow citizen here, hey, do you guys know if my service line is made out of lead or what it's made out of? And I got that answer, and I know that my line is made out of copper. The thing that's kind of disturbing to me in a way is, like, even though I live in this older neighborhood, my home was built in 2005. So I don't have concerns about it having lead paint in it, right? Like, that's not going to be an issue with that new of a home. At this point, I'm trying to get down to what may have caused that exposure. And my hunch is that it's in the soil, because that's another place, another common place besides paint where children, young children, can get exposed to lead. So I'm going to get my soil tested once the snow melts out here, you know, trying to figure out what your line is made out of is not exactly easy. I know some of our staff, especially in Detroit, have tried to get a hold of the same information that I got from the city of Grand Rapids, and they haven't been able to do that yet. This is information that cities should have compiled 25 years ago when the lead and copper rule passed. But this week, the EPA has decided that they want water systems across the state to put that information on their websites. And I have a feeling that that's going to be very difficult for some cities to do, not only because the data is not in an electronic form that you can just throw on a website, but even the paper records that we have in some of these older cities are not exactly accurate, or there's lots of records missing.
So I imagine a lot of people hearing about the exposure in Flint and other cities who found out that they have lead lines, a lot of people are probably getting concerned about this.
I think that you're definitely starting to see more people just look into, do I have a lead service line? Do I not? Is my water safe when it comes to lead? Is it not? There is a demand for tests going on across the state for sure.
So this has been something that's been on your mind a lot. How do you escape from all this kind of dreaded news that you're covering and that you're living?
As much as I've had my head sort of buried in Flint, with that news coverage, certainly the last few months, that I did go to this amazing event this week that was just really fun for me to see. This was in Muskegon Heights, a basketball game. I don't get to go to too many high school basketball games anymore. And this one was really fun because, you know, it was supposed to be a game that Muskegon Heights was going to play against Shelby High School. And because there's been some violence in Muskegon Heights and in the football season, even some games got moved around because some teams weren't comfortable playing in Muskegon Heights. And Shelby canceled. They wouldn't come down. And instead, a team from Kalamazoo came up and played at Muskegon Heights. And just given everything that happened in Kalamazoo, you know, that's another story where we had a bunch of violence in Kalamazoo a little less than 2 weeks ago. And these two communities kind of use this opportunity to say, we're not going to let this violence define us. It was like 2,000 people at this game and everybody was in a good mood and like nothing happened. It was just, it was really uplifting. I didn't get a chance to use all of the tape that I got from that game.
So, you did a story on Michigan Radio.
Yeah. You know, we get 35 seconds or so to pack this into a headline. But I mean, I talked to so many amazing people. So we have some of that tape from the cutting room floor.
You can do that.
Instead of being afraid, you come together during times of crisis. You don't run from crisis, and that's what community's all about. That's what we've tried to do in the last week in Kalamazoo, and certainly I know that's what Muskegon Heights has been doing here. And
we are still Tigers, so
right.
We're not with the whatever the media pumps us up to be, where the bad things happen all through here. That's not the kids that's happening. It's the people that surround the area. It's the adults that come here and start this trouble. It's not the kids themselves. A lot of kids can be troubled. You know, they face a lot of things. Adversity going through school as enough as it is. Last thing they need is, you know, someone to taunt them and make them seem that they're not wanted around. So we got a lot of teams that bagged out because of the so-called this and the safety issues. Any other game, we never had any problems. We never had this much security. We never needed it.
If you think about that, think about these stands being filled, these young people having the opportunity to play the game that they love so much, and have all of these folks standing beside them and behind them, it has to be very meaningful for all of them. And I'm just, again, so proud that people really came out and saw why it was important.
It was Mayor Bobby Hopewell from Kalamazoo that you hear at the end. That was his first time to Muskegon Heights. And so he was just really proud to kind of have that experience. And I think it was quite the game.
Lindsay Smith is our West Michigan reporter who's been covering the Flint story for months. Stateside's executive producer is Joe Lindstrath. Contributors are Cass Adair, Allie Billings, Mike Blank, Josh Hecla, Sean McHenry, and Mercedes Mejia. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Lester Graham. Thanks for listening.